All right, we're ready for Exodus chapters 3 to 5. Next time will be 6 and 7. I'll be out of pocket next Wednesday. And so J.P. Edwards will be teaching the combined classes. The young adult class will be in here. And so you can look forward to his excellent teaching. I've heard him teach many times, and he's an excellent teacher. That'll be next time. For tonight, we're looking at chapters 3 to 5. This is the outline we introduced last time as we introduced the book and looked at chapters 1 and 2. I borrow this from J. Sidlow Baxter. He does an excellent job always. He's not a New Testament Christian, but he is an excellent outliner. And he deals with the Exodus, chapters 1 to 18, and then the law, 19 to 24, and the tabernacle. We're under the Exodus, and we are in the first section here, and we'll get into the second. That is, the Exodus is projected through Moses, and yet it was obstructed through Pharaoh. And we're going to see all of that in our study tonight. We're in the history section as per that outline, that brief outline that is an alternate outline. Chapter 1, what was it about? All right, the children of Israel are suffering in Egypt. We're going to see more about that being increased in our study tonight. Chapter 2. Yeah, the birth of Moses in his early life. Well, that's not too much to remember. We'll get a little more challenging as we go along. So here is chapter 3. We're going to look at chapters 3, 4, and 5. This mostly is very familiar info to us. We'll try to enhance our understanding as we go along. If possible, we'll see what we can do. Three things happen in chapter 3. I simply call this the call of Moses to deliver God's people. God calls upon him from the burning bush. We'll see that in a minute. To deliver the people, to go to Pharaoh and make the call for the deliverance of the people of God. Three things happen here. God calls him out of the burning bush, and then we see God hears the cry in Egypt, and then the last thing in this chapter is the mission of Moses is to go deliver the children of Israel. He goes and first introduces himself to the people as far as being the leader. It seems from our last week's study that Moses has had a hint at that somehow. We don't know how, but he seems to have at least thought that God intended for him to be that, as we saw at the end of chapter 2. Let's start at verse 1. Before we talk about the events of the burning bush, verse 1 said that Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, who was priest of Midian. So he's in the land of Midian. We're going to look at that on a map in a moment. And he led the flock to the back of the desert, which probably means to the west, typical among Hebrews, to speak of the west as being to the back. And he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. I want to talk about the location of all of this here. This is from a work of two excellent students. If you knew them, and I did know them, and have been around them a good bit, Bob and Sandra Waldron, in their work on history and geography of the Bible. This map here, I'm going to blow up just a little bit for you. They suggest, where most maps will talk about the land of Midian, this is the Sinai Peninsula. Just ignore the two shades of areas for the moment. And most will talk about Midian is on this side of the sea here. And that's probably where Moses went. Several think, and the Waldron seem to think that, and they were excellent students of geography, that Midian spilled over and was part of this Sinai Peninsula. Make sense? And that Mount Sinai, and notice you probably can't read right there at my arrow, that's also called Mount Horeb. So where is Mount Horeb? Most think, though no one knows 100% for sure, that Sinai and Horeb are the same mountain. And we're going to make some point about that here in just a second. Now, I'm going to confuse you here just for a moment. That probably is correct. That's the traditional location for Mount Sinai, is right here at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, other maps, and this is one that's put out by some of our brethren, they have Sinai here, but the land of Midian being distinct from that. Well, let's get a little more confusing. This is from Brother Steve Rudd. I've recommended the website a number of times, Bible.ca, particularly if you're looking for a church. He is an archaeologist, and he suggests, he spent a lot of time, whether he's correct or not, I don't know, I haven't looked at all of his evidence, that Sinai is actually over here in what's traditionally thought of as the land of Midian, but he puts Horeb and Sinai not at the Sinai Peninsula, but across the Red Sea over here. Making sense? Whether you agree or not, you see what he's saying? He thinks that's the location and gives hundreds of pages of evidence, and I haven't waded through all of that. I don't know that that makes a big significant difference. He thinks it does. I'm not convinced that it makes a big significant difference. We probably will generally deal with the traditional view. But what I'm trying to get you to see is that Midian very well may spill over into the Sinai Peninsula. So that either location for Mount Sinai would be in the land of Midian. Make sense? Possibly. Can I be 100% sure? No, none of us can be. All right. Now, I want to talk about this being called. I take it that I don't see any reason for thinking it's not Sinai when he talks about Mount Horeb. I want you to look at some locations here, some things that will give us some indication about this mountain. He calls it the mountain of God. So it seems strange to me that he comes just to any mountain and calls it the mountain of God, maybe just because if it's not Sinai, this is the mountain that God spoke to him through the burning bush. But God makes some point about this mountain here. And it seems maybe that this is stated as the mountain of God in light of not only what God does now, but what he's going to do there. Make sense? Maybe. I don't know. There is some conjecture there. Let's add some more information about the mountain of God here that we've been talking about. It's called Mount Horeb, called the mountain of God. And notice at verse 12, later God said that you will serve God on this mountain. What's he talking about? I take he's talking about the events that typically we think of taking place at Mount Sinai. You're going to serve God on this mountain. We're not done with that. Notice in chapter 4, verse 27, when Aaron comes to meet him, as Moses is coming from the land of Midian, let me back up to our map here. As Moses is coming from the land of Midian, let me go back right here. As he's making his way back to Egypt from Midian, and Aaron is coming to meet him, he meets him where? Verse 27, the mountain of God, same place. So it seems to have been something that he would have come through on the way to Midian. That is, perhaps this is where he was, closer to Sinai, when he went to his father-in-law. Make sense? Perhaps it's in that Sinai Peninsula. Or if if Rudd be correct, maybe that he made his way over to here as he's coming to where Moses was. Whatever the case, it's wherever Moses had to go back to Egypt and Aaron had to come toward Midian, they meet at the mountain of God, Mount Horeb, also Sinai. Have I confused you? All right, hopefully not. So anyway, just a little info about location, possible location, and the significance of this mountain. It's not just any mountain. This is called the mountain of God. Now, what happens in verses 1 to 6 at this mountain of God? All right, very good. Several things we want to flag here and pay attention to. Callan Datelich suggests, if you're familiar with their works, they're quite in-depth Old Testament students. They're not always correct, but they do give you something to think about. Though the text doesn't tell us, there is some conjecture here on their part that the bush very well may represent the people of Israel burning that they're burning in affliction, but God's not going to let them be consumed. Was that the significance of the burning bush? I don't know. They make that point. That's interesting that they think that it is supposed to represent God is seeing them burn and he's calling out about the affliction, but I'm not going to let them be consumed. I think it perhaps more suggests the glory of God. Now the text says an angel appeared to him in the flame of fire in the midst of the bush, verse 2, but that angel seems to be referred to as the Lord. So who was this? The answer is We don't know. Some think, Homer Haley, for example, argues, and so do Callan Delitzsch argue, that that has to be the Son of God, that is Christ. And so if it's a messenger of God and the Lord is said to be the one who speaks, that this has to be the Son of God. Maybe. There's no real evidence of that. I'm not convinced that's 100% sure. It very well could be an angel speaking on behalf of God, and thus God is speaking. There are texts that talks about David wrote and the Holy Spirit wrote. David's not the Holy Spirit. It just means the Holy Spirit spoke through David. We see that in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. I'll leave that for you to decide. Let's get down to verse 6. He identifies himself, the one who speaks, that is God, is I am the God. And so is that saying the angel is God? No, if it is merely an angel, a messenger of God, it's God speaking through the angel. But I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. He identifies himself with the God of their fathers. A practical thing to learn from verse 6 is God is the God of the individual, not just of a nation. I'm not just the God of the Israelites. I'm not just the God of a family. I'm the God of Abraham. I'm the God of Isaac. I'm the God of Jacob. He's your God. He's my God. Make sense? He's the God of the individual, not just of the church, not of the family, etc. All right, let's go to verses 7 to 9. God appeared to him out of the burning bush, and while he's speaking to him, he tells him, of course, as we've already noted, that he was to take his sandals off because he's walking on holy ground. Here's what God says. What does he say, 7 through 9? Yeah, I know, I hear, I see, I've seen the oppression, I hear their cry, I know their sorrows, various expressions describing their suffering, and I've come down to deliver them, and what's he going to do with them? Verse 8. Yeah, I'm going to take them to the land of Canaan. I'm going to take them out of Egypt, and we're going to take them to the land of promise, to the land of Canaan is what we're going to do. Now, beginning at verse 10, this is Moses' mission to go deliver the people. So let's divide that out for a little bit. He says, go to Pharaoh and bring my people out. That's the command at verse 10. So come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. There's your mission. That's your job. Moses' reaction to that was what? 11 and 12. Yeah, he's reluctant. He's not sure he's the man for the job. Who am I? He said. Seems humble, doesn't it? You have a little trouble at times with Moses distinguishing between his humility and his reluctance to do what God said. There's sometimes a fine line. I want to be humble. I don't want to think I am the only one, but I don't want to deny God telling me what I'm able to do. Does that make sense? Reminds me of Romans 12. My memory's not serving me the exact wording of that. So let me turn over there. Romans 12 talks about our abilities and makes an interesting point. How we're not to be, I'm looking for verse 3. If I can get my pages unstuck. If someone has verse 12:3, read that for me. There we go. Don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to think, but to think soberly. The idea of thinking soberly is commensurate with the abilities you have. Does that make sense? In other words, I don't need to think I'm better than everyone else. I'm the only person for the job, but I am to think of myself commensurate with the abilities. God's given me the ability, gave me the responsibility. I can and I will do that, but I don't think I'm the greatest thing there ever was. That's the idea. Moses seems to be humble, but at the same time, he's shirking back. God gets angry before he's through. So who am I that I should go deliver the children of Israel? Now what does God say? Verse 12. I'm going to be with you. That should be assurance enough. I'm going to be with you. I've sent you. And here's the sign. What's the sign? When I bring them out of the land of Egypt, you're going to serve God on this mountain. I take that to be that when they come out and what God does on Mount Sinai if there hasn't already been assurance to Moses, Moses should be assured by the time he leaves Sinai, I am with you. You are the man that I chose for the job. Does that make sense? If he hadn't got it by then, he ought to get it when there's the thundering and the lightning and the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. You're going to serve God on this mountain. And when you do, there's your sign that I'm with you. There's your evidence. Now then, let's start at verse 13 now, 13 through 14. Moses asks a question now. Here's something, he seems to be starting making excuses. Here's something you hadn't thought about, God. Who am I going to say sent me? I'm going to go to the children of Israel. I'm going to go to Pharaoh and who do I tell them sent me? And what's God's answer to that? I am who I am. What does that suggest? I have a question on that. Question number four. What does that suggest about the nature of God? All right. It's an affirmation of the eternal nature of God. He's not the one who was, but not anymore, or will be, but not. But he was, is, and ever will be. I am. That's an affirmation of eternity. And it's an affirmation of the eternal nature of God. And so he said, tell them the I am has sent thee. Do you remember when Jesus said, if you believe not that I am he, you shall die in your sins? Remember that statement, John 8, what is that, verse 24? The he is supplied by translators. If you believe not that I am, Jesus is affirming he has the same eternal nature that the Father has. Isn't that interesting? Making that same affirmation, his eternal nature. So now beginning at verse 15 through verse 25, God's going to give his message through Moses to Egypt. So look at verses 15 to 18 now. You go gather the elders together and say to them, here's what God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has said. I'm going to truly visit the people. What else is he to tell them? I've seen your... I've seen your affliction, and I know what's going on in Egypt, and I'm going to take you to the land of, verse 17. Yeah, the land that flows with milk and honey, the land of the Hittites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Amorites, Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, etc. And look at verse 18. Then they will heed your voice. And I might qualify at first. They're not going to always heed his voice. They're going to listen to him at first. When you go to the children of Israel, go to the elders, they're going to heed you at first. And you and the elders of Israel, the king will go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us and we want to go 3 days and journey and sacrifice. And I'll go back to verse 18. Who went to Pharaoh? Some argue that the instructions here is not exactly what was fulfilled in chapter 5. I'm not sure about that. I take it that verse 18 is saying that Moses and Aaron, we know they went in, chapter 5, but that there were the elders of Israel were to go with them. The elders are not mentioned in chapter 5. Does that mean they didn't go? I'm not convinced that meant they didn't go. And that's not a big deal. I'm just not convinced of that. And you may see some evidence they didn't go, and I'd like to see that. But those who argue, and there's some commentators argue that the elders didn't go, and what happened to them, we don't know. Why they didn't go, I don't know. I'm not convinced they didn't, since God said they're going to go in there with you. All right, now let's go to verses 19 to 20. Before he ever goes, what does God tell Moses? He's not going to let it happen. He's not going to let him go. I lost my place. Verse 19. But I'm sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, not even with a mighty hand. That is, even after he sees power, he's finally going to let him go, but not at first. And I'll stretch out my hand and I'll strike Egypt. Now then, verse 21 and 22. Now this is interesting. What's happening in 21 and 22? When you leave, you're not going empty-handed. You're going to take some things from Egypt. I believe it's the old King James, good translation, uses the word borrow. The word does not give the idea of borrowing as we think of it, where if I ask Dickie here, can I borrow a tool, that implies I'm going to take it and bring it back. And if I didn't intend to take it back, I've stolen. It's the idea of asking. The Egyptians had to have every knowledge they were leaving or intending to leave. And so it's the idea here at verse 21 that they're going to ask their neighbors and anyone who's nearby for articles of silver and gold, and they would give that to them. And so God is intending to take the gold and the silver that's going to be ultimately used for the tabernacle and to get into the wilderness, take it from Egypt. And so you're going to plunder Egypt in that sense. You're going to ask, they'll give it to you, and you're going to take it. Make sense? I don't have any indication in this text, or there's no wording in this text that tells me they stole from the Egyptians, that they borrowed, but wink, wink, we're not bringing it back. There's no indication of that. I have no clue that that's what took place. Yeah. Take what you want and get out of here. We're done with y'all. Yeah, good point. All right, questions or comments on chapter 3?
I wonder if Moses was thinking about, we just hear say, but thinking about what happened when he had to leave. He was trying to be the leader then. He was thinking, who am I?
It could be. It very well could be. Some of us talked after class about chapter 2, and I don't want to get too far back into that, but there's something that made Moses think that he was supposed to be a leader. Had God already told him that, where we don't have a record? Maybe. I don't know. But something made him think he was supposed to be the leader to deliver his children, the family of Israel, out of Egypt. What was that? I'm not sure. It may have been some direction from God. Conjecture there, obviously, we know. All right, let's go to chapter 4. Two things happen here in chapter 4. This is Moses' excuses in his trip to Egypt. Moses makes excuses before God for not going, not being the one. And so at verse 1 of chapter 4, here's the first thing. He starts raising questions. Suppose they won't listen. And so who is the they? Is he thinking about the Egyptians or is he thinking about the children of Israel? And so I think he's talking here about the children of Israel. And evidence of that is at the end of the chapter, at verses 30 and 31, as he goes in before the children of Israel and has to convince them first. And so we'll see more of that at verse, but if you want some evidence, look at verse 30 and 31. So this, I think, is talking about, suppose the children of Israel, when I go tell them, God sent me to be your leader, what if they don't listen? So again, it comes across to me in verse 1, like, God, you hadn't thought about this. Let me pose a situation you hadn't thought about. Suppose they won't listen to me, or suppose they say the Lord hasn't appeared to you. And so what does God do? There's three things. All right, let's talk about each one of these as we come to them. Said, what's that in your hand? And it's a staff. It's a shepherd's staff, seeing to flock. Something that is an abhorrence, as we already saw, to the Egyptians. Remember, Joseph had said that when his brothers came. You know, don't tell them you're shepherds. Remember that? And take that's in your hand and cast it on the ground. And what did it become? A serpent. And then told him, pick it up by its tail. And when he did, it became the rod or the staff once again. So what does all three of these suggest? Let's get to the overall picture. The overall picture of all three of the signs is just the power of God. That's the point. The power of God. You're asking me, suppose they won't listen to me. Let me show you signs that you can convince them with. Some have suggested, and I know there's some conjecture here, but for what it's worth, that the staff was an abhorrence to the Egyptians. And he cast it down, it becomes a serpent, which may have represented the power of Egypt. And so there was the serpent was a symbol of power for the Egyptians. And yet God could take that serpent and turn it back into this staff once again. The bottom line is God's going to have power over Egypt. God can have power. Look at the power of God. You want a sign? Here's a sign. They won't believe you that I sent you? Here's a sign you can show them. He does that at verse 30 and 31. All right, what's the second thing he does? But before we leave that, look at verse 5 before we leave that. This is that they may believe the Lord God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you. It's not just some God, but the same God that dealt with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the same God that appeared to you. That's what they're going to conclude. Now, what was the second sign? Yeah. It's leprous. It's has leprosy, basically. And then he tells him to do what? Put it back in, and he comes out restored as all the other flesh. What is it saying? Power of God again. Look at what God can do. God can take the leprosy, and he can clean it again. And so it may suggest the impurity of Egypt will be cleaned. They're no longer going to be in the impurity of Egypt, but God can clean them. Just as you went down into Egypt and became contaminated, I'm going to bring you out of Egypt and cleanse you by bringing you out of Egypt. Maybe. But what it is saying is the power of God. The third sign, which is no indication that he ever used this in the sense here because it wasn't necessarily needed. Now, I'll get to that in a moment. What was the third sign? Yeah, take that water, pour it on dry land, and it'll become blood. Now, the water, the Nile River, was first a life support for the Egyptians, number one. It was their water supply. And number two, it was an object of worship. And to turn that into blood meant death and power over the Egyptians. So if anything that should have been understood from this is, first of all, the power of God and power over the Egyptians. Have you been sent to us, Moses, and look at the signs? Yes, he's been sent. Look at these signs. Making sense? There may be something symbolic in those, or it just may be the overall picture of the power of God. Now, let's start at verse 10. At verse 10, he makes another excuse. I'm not an eloquent speaker. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. I'm just not a good speaker. And so God's response at verse 11, God's beginning to get a little agitated about this, do you think? I take it. What question does he ask him? Who made man's mouth? And who makes the mute and the deaf and the seeing and the blind? Have I not the Lord? In other words, I'm the one that created your mouth, and you're telling me you can't use that and it's not good enough to do the job I gave you to do? Seems to be a rebuke to Moses. And now, therefore, go and I will be your mouth and teach you what to say. In other words, you don't have to worry about what to say. I want to teach you what to say. That tells me that Moses would be... Who said that? Inspired, exactly. He's going to be inspired in his speech. There's a third thing he says, which we don't have it outlined as a third point, but part of this being slow of speech and slow of tongue. What does he say at verse 13? This is the job for somebody else. You ever said that? Somebody else can do that better. And so, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Someone else could do a better job. Now, verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Do you see a developing concept that Moses, as great as he was, has a little bit trouble believing God? You say, I don't know if I'd use that strong language. God did in Numbers 20. I'll tell you, God said, you did not believe me. He has a little trouble believing God when God says, you're the man for the job. He said, no, I'm not. You're going to be my spokesman. I can't be. If Moses had trouble believing God, finish my sentence. Do what? They would too, but somebody else may have a trouble. Maybe me. Yeah. Maybe you. Practical thing to learn. Yeah, he still, that's a good point. He's seen these three signs. He saw two of them and then told about a third one that he could perform. And he's still having trouble thinking he's the man for the job. You need to get somebody else. So the anger of the Lord was stirred. And so he tells him about his brother Aaron. Aaron hasn't been around in a while. So let's make a marginal note. Let's flag some things here at verse 16. You might underline two words, and then we're going to flag another verse and draw a conclusion from it. He will be your spokesman. English Standard says what? Your mouth. He's going to be your spokesman, and he shall be a mouth for you. I'm reading from the New King James. He's going to be your mouth. He's going to be your spokesman. Make a marginal note to see chapter 7 and verse 1. What does chapter 7 and verse 1 call him? He will be your prophet. There's your biblical definition of a prophet. Well, often we think of a prophet as a foreteller. He foretells the future. Well, prophets did that. That's true. But the main function of a prophet was to be a spokesman for another. Now, and you shall be to him as God. You're going to be in the place of telling him what to say, and he's going to tell it. So here's how a prophet works. God tells the prophet, and the prophet speaks. Make sense? You want to know a definition of a prophet? You just saw one right there in the text. Powerful. Now then, let's start at verse 18, and let's get Moses down to Egypt. Moses goes to his father Jethro and asks him could he go, and he said, go in peace. And so Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to Egypt, and Moses took the rod in his hand. He takes this rod God tells him to take. He's going to use it time and again. All right, verses 21 to 23, let's pause for a moment and learn some things about the hardening of the heart. God said, you go back to Egypt and you go to and do all the wonders before Pharaoh that I will put in your hand, but I will harden his heart. And he will not let them go. You might underline that. Might make a marginal note to the side to see chapter 8 and verse 32. What am I going to learn from 8:32? God said, I will harden his heart. 8:32 says, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Contradiction? No, not at all. How did God harden his heart? You read all the story, and when we get through with the book of Exodus, and you get done, and read any other reference about Moses dealing with Pharaoh, all you will ever find that God did to Pharaoh was give him the demand, let my people go. That's all God did. Now, did God work signs and wonders? Yes. But my point is, all he ever did to Pharaoh in his heart was tell him, let my people go. It wasn't what Pharaoh wanted. Pharaoh hardened his own heart. The way God hardened his heart was giving him a demand he didn't want to follow. Does that make sense? So you tell your child, you have to stay indoors today, it's raining outside, but they want to go outside. And they want to go outside so bad they may go out anyway. You made them disobey. How did you make them disobey? By giving them a rule. If you hadn't given them a rule, they wouldn't be disobeying. Does that make sense? That's all God did to Pharaoh. All right. Now let's get on to some more stuff that's a little bit difficult, or at least challenging to us. Beginning at verse 24, Zipporah circumcised her son. Now, she seems to be exasperated here. There's some practical things to learn here, I think. At verse 24, and they came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met with him, that is with Moses, and sought to kill him. Now, on a cursory reading of that, that's kind of shocking. That God sought to kill him. And then the very next statement says, then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, surely you're a husband of blood to me. Now, I'm a little slow to learn, but she doesn't seem very happy to me. She seems to be a little on the ill side. Wouldn't you take it? It must have something to do with verse 24. So let's see if we can make some sense of that. How did God seek to kill him? Either by a warning about death, or he may have been struck with disease somehow. We're not told how God did that. I have a hard time concluding God attempted to kill him, wanted to kill him, but he didn't. Obviously, God didn't kill him because he lives on. But the wording of it sounds as if he sought to kill him and tried, but he failed. I have to have a hard time thinking if God wanted to kill him that God failed in that. I think my God's, pardon the expression, but God's a better shot than that. If he wanted to kill him, believe he could do it. In other words, I think it's a warning of death, and it must have something to do with not circumcising his child on the eighth day like he should have, like Genesis 17 said. Does that make sense? Because this statement is made, and immediately, seemingly to save his life, Zipporah, his wife, circumcises her son. I take it that Moses was not physically able to do that because of whatever is going on, his sickness or near-death experience. Now, there's a couple of things to learn from that. One is, he is not fit to be a leader if he's not following the instructions of God himself. Does that make sense? Who is he to go and tell the people, I'm going to lead you, and I'm going to go to Pharaoh, and I'm going to lead y'all out, and I'm the spokesman for God, when someone could point to him and say, well, here's your son who was not circumcised the eighth day like God told you. He is not fit to be a leader if he's not following the instructions of God himself. Does that make sense? So why did he not do that? I don't know. Was Moses lax? Or was it, and this text may argue for that, some opposition on the part of Zipporah? She's from the land of Midian. She's not from the land of Israel. And this was a religious thing. This was not a matter of a medical procedure. This was a religious thing, and she likely could not have seen any value in this of religious. Now, why would anybody do this? Why would God ask them to do this? And she may have posed some opposition. And in order to save his life, she has her child circumcised and cast the foreskin at his feet and saying, surely you are a husband of blood to me, she says. And now, footnote, chapter 18, verse 2 is the next time we see Zipporah. Chapter 18, verse 2 says, Moses sent her back to Midian. And her father brings her to Moses in chapter 18, verse 2. So we're not going to see her for a while. She's kind of off the scene. She's kind of ill here, seems to me like. And she just doesn't understand. Questions or comments on that? Now then, 27 to 31, Aaron and Moses. This is where Aaron comes and meets him at the mountain of God here. That's interesting, where we've been talking about. I take that to be Sinai, Mount Horeb. And so Moses told Aaron all the words and all the signs which he had been commanded. No indication he showed these signs to Aaron, but this is what God did for me. He did these signs for me, and I'm the spokesman. I'm supposed to go, and you're supposed to go with me. And then verse 30, they did all of these signs in the sight of the people. In verse 31, what was the reaction of the people? They believed. God said they would, and they did. And now we're ready to go before Pharaoh. Questions or comments? All right, let's see if we can get through chapter 5 now. We have just a few minutes to go. Not as much that we need to flag in chapter 5, so I think we'll be able to make it through and get the gist of chapter 5. Verses 1 to 5, Moses and Aaron plead with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said no. Now, as I mentioned earlier, did the elders go in with them? I take it they did because God said they would. They're not mentioned here. Unless I missed it, I didn't see them mentioned here. If you see it, I honestly am saying I didn't see it. Maybe you did. So they go into Pharaoh, and they say, let my people go. And what was his reaction to that? Who is this God that I should let do whatever he says and obey him? And you're taking the people away from their labor, verse 4. And the people of the land are many, and you make them rest from the labor. You're taking them away from the work, and they need to be working, and they need to be our slaves, and they need to be getting the job done. He wasn't concerned at all about letting them go. So let's start at verse 6. Now what happens? All right. What did he do to make it harder? Yeah, they'd been taking, being supplied the supplies to make brick out of, the straw to make brick out of, and now they have to go round up their straw. Do what? Yeah, picking up, and so they're having a hard time getting that, but there's something else makes it even difficult. That might not be too bad to go get the straw. Had to keep the work quota going. So you can imagine, you can't hardly keep up with doing what you're already doing when supplies are given to you, and now you got to go get the supplies and keep up the quota, and so now what happens? Beginning at verse 6, through verse 21, the taskmasters, I'm going to drop down to verse 10. The taskmasters said they wouldn't give the straw, and they called for the officers of the children of Israel who had been put over them. So there was children of Israel who put over certain sections or groups of workers. Why are you dealing with us this way, they ask. And notice what happens at verse 16. Things are getting worse. Yeah, and Moses, or the not Moses, but the officer said, it's the fault of your own people. See, it's not us, it's the fault of your own people. And he said, but you're idle, that's the problem. Now I want to drop down to 22 and 23 here and finish this up. The people's reaction when they come out and they say to Moses, what they say to him, verse 21. Moses, you are the one made this harder. If you hadn't gone to Pharaoh, this wouldn't have happened. Things have gotten worse because of that. So Moses goes to God, and what does Moses say? Same thing. Why did you do this? Look at the wording of verse 22. We're going to make a practical point about this. You brought trouble on this people. Why is it that you sent me? See, things were bad. You sent me to Pharaoh, and now things are worse. Why did you do this? Here's a practical lesson. If we don't get anything else, this will be something good for us to learn. It often looks like God's plan doesn't work. In fact, we think it makes things worse. You've ever seen that? Discipline the child because of the problem, and things will get better. And you do that and things get worse, and you say, well, it doesn't work. Things were going bad, but they've gotten worse now that I've tried to implement discipline. Church discipline the same way. I thought things were bad, but we started exercising discipline, and now we've got chaos. Oh, man, it doesn't work. Why did we try it? Why did we do it? Sometimes doing what God tells us to do makes things worse in our eyes at first. Does that make sense? Is this plan going to work? Is this plan going to work? I'm talking about with Moses. You bet it is. It's going to work. He's going to get the people out. But it isn't like man thinks it's going to work. Any questions or comments? Our time is about gone. Yeah, we want them quick. Exactly. I think there's something to that. I don't think God's making Pharaoh do it, but he's using the stubbornness of Pharaoh to teach his people something that they need to see. I think that's a good point. Anything else? Another practical lesson. We're going to stop right there. Chapter 6 and 7 next time. JP will be teaching. And so be ready for chapter 6 and 7 next time.